From KCPW in Salt Lake City, I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Fraudsters and scam artists have gotten a fair bit of attention here in Utah, but what about the fraud that occurs within families? A recent study shows thieves are taking $1 million a week from Utah's senior citizens. And most often the perpetrators are the children and grandchildren of these folks. They steal their cars, they forge checks, they filch medications. Seniors are also often medically and psychologically fragile, making them easy targets for physical intimidation and neglect. Today on the program, we're talking about elder abuse here in Utah and renewed efforts to prevent and prosecute exploitation of seniors. Plus, international development work, we hear one woman's story of making a difference overseas. All that and your calls after the news. Good morning. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. Aging comes with physical aches and pains, but Utah's elderly are also being hurt in other ways. Seniors are getting ripped off by scam artists. Some are intimidated by their own children. Others financially exploited by their grandchildren. A 2011 report shows that Utah seniors lose $1 million to thieves, and that's in the average week. Today on the program, we're talking about elder abuse in Utah and ways to increase respect for our elders. Joining us on the program is Nan Mendenhall. She is the director of the Division of Adult Protective Services for the state of Utah. Nan, good morning.
Good morning.
Also with us, Elizabeth Salas is Public Information Officer for the Utah Department of Human Services. And Liz, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Greg Fairbrush spent 6 years in the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office prosecuting cases involving aggravated elder abuse. And he continues to be involved with elder abuse prosecution in his role at the Utah Attorney General's Office of Secure Strike Force. And Greg is joining us in the studio as well. Greg, good morning.
Good morning.
All three of these folks are part of the Salt Lake Elder Abuse Project. And if you've got questions or comments, feel free to join us, 801-355-TALK. Later on in the program, we turn to why many Utahns reach out to do good works globally. We'll hear about one woman's efforts in Tanzania. But first, protecting grandma. Do you know of a senior who's been ripped off or worse, threatened by a family member? What more do you think can be done to prevent elder abuse in families and in our community? You can join us again at 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Nan, I want to start with you. Define elder abuse for us. What does the term encompass?
Elder abuse, as by statute, involves a vulnerable adult. And here in the state of Utah, vulnerable adult means anyone over the age of 18 that has a physical or mental impairment, or anyone over the age of 65. It's a protected class. So abuse, as it goes, it can break up into, you have your physical abuse, but you also have your emotional abuse, where they threaten, they harass, to where they intimidate the vulnerable adult. And so physical is anyone where they're striking, hitting, pulling on a victim. We would look at that as abuse. And then the emotional, like I had said, anything verbal that intimidates the victim, we would look at that.
Give us a recent example, a case where a Utah senior has been intimidated or neglected or abused in some way.
Well, a very common situation where we may have a grandchild living in the home of a grandparent, and grandma may have some prescription drugs that are not, you know, like a pain pill to relieve some of the arthritis. And so the grandchild intimidates grandma, harasses her into giving them her pills so they can take care of their addiction, and leaves grandma without her own medication. We would look at that as far as a neglect, because it is a form, grandma needs that medication to help her deal with the pain. But we also look on the financial side of it, because grandma is paying money for that medication. They're still in that money, what she's paid for the narcotic for that. So that is a very common one, is stealing a elderly person's pharmaceutical pills and prescriptions.
Mm. Greg, you've been quite involved in prosecutions in your previous role at the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office. Do you have a recent example of someone who's been neglected or abused and that you've been able to prosecute?
I do. I think, you know, a lot of the cases that we prosecute involve elements of abuse, of neglect, of exploitation. A lot of the time you'll find that exploitation is the motive. The neglect is the result, where they obtain the money and they don't provide the necessary care to the elder adult that they're living with. It does evolve into abuse at times, but I think a lot of the time you'll see that it's neglect, where the person is not able to take care of themselves. They are left in their bed. They're not taken care of. Malnutrition, bed sores. Bed sores are a very serious form of neglect. And eventually, if left, even in a short period of time, can cause the person's death. Mm. So I think that's a lot of the cases that we see. And I think it's important to understand that when you're looking at elder abuse cases, it's in the context that it involves elements of child abuse, where child abuse was 30 years ago. It involves domestic violence, where domestic violence was about 15 years ago, where it's in the developing stages of our ability to prosecute based on both training and experience with these cases. They're very specialized cases. They're very difficult cases. And, I think in a child abuse case, if a three-month-old has a broken arm, caretaker, the caretaker is not, it's not an excuse to say I'm overwhelmed. And I think we have to remember that in elder abuse cases as well, that, overwhelmed caretaker is not an excuse. And a lot of the time you'll find that the exploitation was the motive, the financial exploitation, as Nan said, the pharmaceutical, stealing the medication, using the medication for their own means. So, without getting into a specific case, I think that's generally what you'll see in most of the cases that you prosecute. Mm.
Liz Aulis, how common is elder abuse?
Unfortunately, it's very common. Last year, we investigated over 3,000 cases in Utah. Nationally, statistics vary that between 1 in 5 or 1 in 10 cases are reported. So that leaves a whole bunch of cases who are not reported to the proper authorities. And I think part of the reason they're not reported, and I believe Greg and Nan could attest to this, is because the majority of the perpetrators are family members, it's difficult, and a caregiver perhaps, it's difficult to get prosecution because that individual who's been victimized is dependent upon them for care. Mm. And many times they feel like, well, they were caring for me, so it's okay if they buy that Cadillac Escalade. Well, you've got to look at what kind of care they're giving, and does it equate to the purchase of that vehicle, and how is that vehicle going to aid the elder adult, or is it at all? In most cases, at least those that we've seen, it's just a matter of a family member being selfish.
Hmm. Can you give us a profile of the victims? Who are these victims? What do they look like?
They're anybody's grandmother or grandfather. Typically what we see is they're females. They're living at home alone, over 60 years of age. And again, the perpetrator is a family member.
Speaking with Liz Aulis, she's Public Information Officer for the Utah Department of Human Services. Also with us, Nan Mendenhall, Director of the Division of Adult Protective Services for the state of Utah, and Greg Fairbrush. He is a former prosecutor in the Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office, currently with the Utah Attorney General's Office. All three are part of the Salt Lake Elder Abuse Project, and we are talking about elder abuse, the causes, the perpetrators, and ways to prevent it. 801-355-TALK is our number if you'd like to join us. 801-355-8255. We've kind of given a broad overview of the scope of the problem. Let's kind of drill down on some of the specifics. Let's go into this financial abuse. The state has recently started looking into financial crimes against seniors and discovered that Utah seniors are being bilked out of $52 million a year. I mean, that's a staggering number. Nan Mendenhall, how did you come up with this number?
Our legal services developer, Julian Gunther, took our APS cases from 2010 and analyzed the financial exploitation, strictly cases. And from that, she extracted data from our cases that would indicate the value of what was being stolen. So if it was a car, she looked up on the Blue Book to see what the value of the car was. If it was from a checking account, my investigators are are really good with putting the numbers down. And so she calculated all those, and it came out to over $52 million.
Wow, $1 million a week.
Yeah, and keep in mind, the only 1 in 10 cases ever get reported, so that number is much higher than $52 million.
Now, about a quarter of these financial crimes have to do with people stealing or forging checks.
Correct.
So that's pretty common. You know, you take grandma's checkbook and write out a check to yourself. Is that what's going on?
We see that. We see that grandma, because of her handshakes too much while writing a check, so she's asked her caregiver or another family member to write a check out for her and send it in to maybe pay for a utility payment. And so what they do is now they have access to that checkbook. And grandma, you know, writes a check once or twice a month, so she doesn't regularly see her checkbook. So they'll take it, tear off the back check, and write a check out to themselves. Hmm. Or they might have grandma sign a check and then later on fill out who they want that check for. That is very common practice, is that the perpetrators will mislead grandma on who she's writing that check out for, because she's trusting these individuals that they wouldn't do her any harm.
When does it cross the threshold into abuse, though? I mean, you know, if you're struggling, you're a young college student, and your grandma's going to give you $20. So where's the line between, you know, a family member helping another family member in need and exploitation?
It crosses the line is when they start using grandma's money for their own needs. And it's pretty clear in state statute. If the money is used for someone else's purposes, not for the purpose of the victim. So we really look at that. And Greg may be able to answer this question better because he's on the prosecution end of things. But we look at what was the intent, what was the purchase for. And it's okay for grandma to give money as a gift, and we look at that, but it's when she doesn't realize that she's making a car payment on a car that she had no idea she owned. And it's causing her not to be able to pay for some medication that she needs. That's when the red flags are, that we look at those.
Hmm. Greg, anything to add on that point?
Yeah, I think the difficulty is when you look at the case, determining whether or not it's a gift, whether grandma's just being grandma and taking care of her grandchild. And when it crosses over into an exploitation, I think, you know, we have to be aware of the elder adult's autonomy, their decision-making ability. We look at capacity a lot of the time, and history. So if grandma's is always giving $1,000 every Christmas, you know, it wouldn't be that unusual, even though she's lost capacity or losing capacity, that she continue to do so. Hmm. On a grandma with limited means, or a grandpa on limited means, and they have their grandchild living there to provide care, if you see that the conduct changes dramatically, where, you know, it's a $10,000 gift or a vehicle that grandpa never could afford, now, I mean, he's buying a convertible Porsche or Miata or whatever the grandchild wanted. Because it's out of character, that does, you know, cause us to look at the case a little bit closer. And I think capacity is a big part of that. And you can really see when the exploitation is not for the benefit of the elder. So if they are of limited means and, you know, they are near poverty and the grandchild is living it up, I think it becomes much more evident you know, that exploitation is occurring.
On the prosecution side, I mean, why start digging into this issue? I mean, is this a trend line going? You know, have you seen an uptick in cases where it could be elder abuse? Or is elder abuse a new law that you just decided to start pursuing vigorously? What's the history there?
No, I think it's a great question. And kind of as I alluded to earlier, I think, you know, 30 years ago, we were looking at child abuse, and it was developing. We were becoming aware of it, so that when children showed up at the hospital, you know, the training and the experience of the medical providers, DCFS, the Division of Child and Family Services, became more involved. They had the laws behind them and the ability to become more involved. I think that happened with domestic violence 10, 15 years ago, that we're becoming more aware of it. We're reporting it more. When law enforcement shows up at the home, they handle it differently than they did before. And I think it's just the evolution now, not only the evolution of both our training experience, our awareness, But also, I think the generation now, you know, the baby boomers are becoming of an age where, you know, they're a generation of demand, I think, is what we talked about the other day. And so, you know, they're demanding investigation, they're demanding prosecution, and I think they have a right to do so. And so I think we're just kind of growing into that area, and I think it's a very difficult area of law, and I think it really takes people that are dedicated to seeing people be held accountable.
We're talking about elder abuse and how many Utah seniors are being taken advantage of, most often by someone they know and love. Joining me in studio is Greg Fairbrush. He is a former Salt Lake County District Attorney, and he's now in the Utah Attorney General's office. Also with us, Nan Mendenhall, Director of the Division of Adult Protective Services for the state of Utah, and Liz Solis with the Utah Department of Human Services. And if you'd like to join us, 801-355-TALK is our number. 801-355-8255. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. This is City Views. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce. Many children and grandchildren justify taking grandpa's car or taking control of grandma's bank account by saying the goods will be theirs anyway, eventually. But that doesn't make it right or lawful. Today on the program, we're talking about the various forms of elder abuse that prosecutors and social workers are seeing here in the state of Utah and what can be done. Nan Mendenhall is director of the Division of Adult Protective Services for the state of Utah. Liz Solis is spokesperson for the Utah Department of Human Services, and Greg Fairbrush is with the Utah Attorney General's Office, a former Salt Lake County District Attorney prosecutor. And all three are part of the Salt Lake Elder Abuse Project. And you can join us if you like. What more do you think can be done to prevent the exploitation and neglect of Utah's seniors? Give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Liz Solis, a fair bit of the crimes, the financial crimes against people who are older have to do with their homes. Describe what the issue is with homes and how elder abuse figures into that equation.
Well, as most of us in society now, having property is one can be one of our greatest assets and is one of those things that can provide us security in our older age. So people have homes. And when that is their primary asset, there are a lot of people who will exploit them to gain access to either the equity in the home or just the home in general. And when that happens, and when we look at some of these other crimes of financial exploitation, it really, when it depletes the funds of these seniors or the assets of these seniors, they don't have a means to recover it in most cases. And I think that's why when you were asking earlier, you know, what is the big deal? That's the big deal. It's not okay for individuals to exploit these people of their property and their income and put them in a position where now they are not only homeless, but they're dependent upon the taxpayers' dollars to live in facilities for seniors. And I think that is something that people need to bear in mind, and especially if you have a family member who's reaching the age where they may need to have more care or attention paid to them. You know, one of the things you're going to be looking at is their home and if the equity in their home could help provide for their care. And so if someone takes advantage of that and exploits some of it, then you don't. That's one less tool or means for them to get the care that they need. And it's just, it's their property. And somehow we don't see somebody going over and having somebody sign over a title. A lot of us will turn our eye at that. But yet if I watched you go over and steal a bike off a porch, I'd report it right away to law enforcement. But I could watch you take my grandma's home right out from underneath her and not even think twice about it. So I think people really need to be more aware of what's taking place and question your gut. The way the law is written, you're only supposed to suspect abuse, neglect, or exploitation. You don't need to know. In fact, we prefer you don't investigate. And if you have that suspicion, even the tiniest bit, you should report it to either Adult Protective Services or law enforcement. And Adult Protective Services phone number is 1-800-371-7897. It's statewide. You can call them. You can report anonymously. All the information is confidential, so that's to protect both the victim and those who are reporting.
We'll put that number on our website, kcpw.org. And Nan Mendenhall, in the financial report, it does say that, you know, a senior may have collected a nice little nest egg for themselves to look forward to the future, to make sure that they have the funds and the means to take care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And yet when they are bilked out of this money, all of us as a society pay in the form
Correct.
Of Medicaid and other resources that we give to take care of people.
Correct.
So, you know, it's not just one family's problem.
No, it's not. It's the residents of Salt Lake County, if you're living in the county, but it's a statewide problem because ultimately when they become indigent and they there's nowhere to go. For instance, we had a situation where a family member abused the power of attorney, and the elder adult signed the power of attorney knowing the son. The son in this particular case promised mom that he would take care of her and she can remain in the home. As soon as she signed the power of attorney over, he activated it, he liquidated all of her assets, and then kicked her into a nursing home. She did not need to be in a nursing home. She could live on her own. But by the time we got involved and law enforcement got involved, he had spent every dime. And so now, and he couldn't pay her back. And so now she is sitting in a facility. Who's going to pay her bills? And you know, in situations like that, it's very difficult at times even to get Medicaid to pay for that. But I believe we worked with the family and her and the ultimate. And she was living in a situation where she was thought it was a good idea to be living in. But those are the things that we see all the time is. Poor choices with the family members at first. They may have really no ill intention to exploit grandma, but once they get the cash in their hands, greed usually kicks in. Mm. And that's when we see most of the situations evolve is they want to spend it on themselves instead of on grandma's care or mom's care because, you know, they view it as their inheritance and they want to protect it. And so they would rather, you know, take from the elder and be selfish and don't really care what happens.
Hmm. Speaking with Nan Mendenhall, she is director of the Division of Adult Protective Services for the state of Utah. Also, Liz Solis, a public information officer for the Utah Department of Human Services, and Greg Fairbrush, who is currently with the Utah Attorney General's Office, formerly prosecutor with Salt Lake County DAs. If you'd like to join us, if you've got questions or comments about elder abuse in our community, 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to the phones, and Marie is joining us from Salt Lake City. Marie, hi.
Hi. My question is, are there any laws, and I guess you started to touch on it a little bit, where the family and sometimes maybe the older person is even involved in it, where they take all their assets out of their name because they want to qualify for the federal assistance or the state assistance and not have their money be kind of gobbled up and all of their resources used in taking care of them. Are there any ways that we kind of track and kind of try to keep that down to a minimum if they do have assets?
Okay, good question, Marie. Thanks for the call. Laws against preventing people from taking the assets out of the elder's name so they qualify for Medicaid. Greg?
Yeah, you know, that's a little bit out of my expertise, but I think it deals with fraud, and a lot of the time Medicaid or Medicare, Social Security, when we do see that or when the administrations become aware of that, they do investigate that. If it's a federal agency, then it'll be a federal investigation. Certainly if it's a state agency, it'll be a state investigation. Our focus is when they are in fact victim, if that case is presented either to APS or to a prosecuting agency, you know, they'll certainly want to look the capacity of the elder adult and make sure and determine that, that they are acting on their own behalf. And if they are, certainly there is some criminal ramification for that. Mm. It's a little outside my expertise. So
yeah, do you have something to add?
Yeah, I think, if I can recall, there's almost like a four-year window that someone can set aside someone's assets. I'm also not a professional, can give my opinion on that, but you can contact the Medicaid Fraud Unit. You can also go to utah.gov to the Medicaid eligibility website, and they will give, there's some information there on their websites that will help guide you through that. But the healthcare facility through the Department of Health, I believe, is the one that administers those type of programs. Mm.
Marie, thanks very much for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Let's go to Miriam, who's calling from Salt Lake City. Miriam, hi.
Hi. I've done some work with APS in the past, and they're just wonderful. Man, you're fabulous. But I had a question. When something does happen, an older person is abused or exploited, or, you know, maybe a child forges a name and does something, I found that there's a lot of embarrassment and shame and guilt. And they don't want to report it because it could get the kid in trouble or whatever. And I was just wondering if there is any kind of educational program or outreach to help people get past that and get things taken care of correctly.
Miriam, you bring up a good point. Thanks for the call. And I do imagine that for many seniors, this is very complicated. They're in a relationship with this person. It's not, you know, some stranger who's trying to bilk them out of something or scam them. They don't want to damage the people they love. And yet they are being damaged themselves. Nan, what kind of resources are out there to help older people get over the embarrassment or the shame of being taken advantage of?
We work with victim services quite often on cases that we feel like the victim needs some additional resources. Unfortunately, my agency doesn't have the funding to provide ongoing services, so we rely heavily on the community and various agencies to provide that. So we hook them up with the victim services, and through their services, they can do it, get the one-on-one counseling. And we also talk to the victim. What do they actually want? And we specifically, if they want some ongoing counseling, we'll help facilitate some of the, refer them to some of the local areas that does counseling for the seniors. Mm.
And I think from at the prosecutorial aspect of it, there's victim advocates. Most prosecuting agencies have victim advocates that are available. And really, what she's talking about is the domestic violence element, where you know, it's a loved one, that's the person that provides care. If you report it, you lose your caretaker. What are you going to do then? So there are some really significant issues that arise when the victim reports it, and that they have to take into consideration.
Does the victim have to come forward in order for a case to proceed?
Well, that's a great question, and I think that really is a case by determined on a case by case basis. But what I think is important is that as we become more capable of prosecuting these cases by, you know, looking at bank records, looking at other witnesses and other people being involved in identifying these cases as they're happening, that we can begin to go forward on cases that the victim isn't as necessary. A lot of the time in domestic violence cases, you'll find that the victim wants prosecution, but they don't want to be the person who is the material witness or the person that has to explain the entire case to the jury. And so as we get better with elder abuse, we are better able to develop the case in a way that protects the victim so they don't have to testify against their grandchild. I mean, how awful would that be? But it may be a necessary element. If we can avoid that, we certainly attempt to do that.
Liz, did you have something to add on the resources end?
Yeah, I was just going to mention, I mean, by the time we get involved as Adult Protective Services, it's at a place of investigation. But there are resources in the community through the area agencies on aging. They've got senior centers across the state where people can go and receive all kinds of information, training, outreach, as well as support from other seniors and a safe place if they need to talk to somebody. And in addition to the senior centers across the state, the area agencies on aging have a variety of other services where if seniors take advantage of them early on and have a lot of these resources in place, or at least knowledge of them, it may prevent some of the abuse, neglect, and exploitation, because not only are they more aware, but there are more people who are able to see what's going on or taking place in their home. And again, with most of the victims living at home, the only way people are getting inside the home is, in most of the cases, it's 911, first responders are showing up for things and seeing things and then making the referral. A lot of these people aren't getting out and doing things. And we know, even from a health perspective, by going out and remaining social, that not only is good for your body, but it's good for your mind, and it might be good for your finances. So,
thanks, Miriam, for the call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255. Talking about elder abuse, and last Friday was World Elder Abuse Awareness Day. Nan, I understand that you hosted the 4th annual Elder Abuse Prevention Summit. About 150 people attended. What kind of response are you getting to education? Do you feel like the word is getting out there, putting families on notice, giving seniors a leg up on what their rights are and maybe what they should be aware of?
We are. Education is a big component of our program. In talking with individuals, not many people, they're all aware of child welfare and that there's an investigative agency. Not many people are aware that Adult Protective Services exist. Mm-hmm. And so we have to go out and educate. I had a conversation the other day with a professional in the medical industry with knowing what he did every day. He was not aware that he was a mandatory reporter, that the state is a mandatory reporting state. So like Liz has mentioned earlier, if you suspect, you need to call APS intake. And so we have to go out and educate individuals like that because they just don't know we exist, and we can go out and educate and also investigate. And so education is very important for
us. That's a little surprising that a doctor might not know that obligation.
Yeah. I was shocked, but it's very common. Mm. Very, very common. We work with a lot of the local universities to get into the nursing programs and also into the medical schools up there to get the doctors before they come out of medical school to educate them. Also, the same thing we do with law enforcement. We're on with this coalition that we're currently all working on, where our goal is to train all law enforcement judges and attorneys so they become aware of the elder abuse cases.
I understand that the Salt Lake Elder Abuse Project last year received a $400,000 federal grant to really target women over age 50 who have been victims of abuse or neglect. Greg, maybe tell us how this money's being used. Can you give us an example of somebody who's benefited from the grant?
Well, at this point, we're still in the training process. I think where our focus is with law enforcement, and I think by doing that, it's really kind of the grassroots level. As we're training law enforcement, we're also working on getting groups together, people that are experts in particular areas of elder issues, and bringing everybody together so that we have a panel, if you will, or a committee that can really get together, identify any issue that is presented to us, and address it quickly. And I think that's ultimately our goal. We hope to have that in place in the next year or two so that we have a basic foundation of trained law enforcement, trained APS, trained prosecutors, trained defense attorneys, everybody that's involved in I guess the criminal aspect, but also with that have this panel that's in place so that any issue that arises can be addressed quickly. And I think that's ultimately our goal. We spoke about, or I mentioned earlier, where there's a, you know, if the caretaker is the perpetrator and is removed from the home, whether the person goes to jail or prison, or it's just, you know, there's no contact or protective order or whatnot, you know, ultimately we would like to have quick placement, whether it be that the person, the elder adult, can remain in the home, which is an important element. If they choose to be at home, get the services in place so that they can continue to do so. I mean, they're a victim. We don't want to victimize them twice or make it worse than it has to be. Or if they're invalid or not able to take care of themselves, that we get them placed quickly until we get the resources in place that we can move them back to their home if they choose to do so. You know, these are huge issues. They're issues that we're working on, and we're developing ways to address them. And I think that's really the goal, at least the three of us and everybody on that panel.
Yeah, and one more thing. Even though primarily our victims are females, we do have male victims. And part of this coalition is to look at victims over male victims, too, over the age of 50, because it does happen to them. They are abused also. And so it's key. It's kind of misleading from where we get the money from, because it's older victims. We've been informed that we need to include the male victim in there also, and so it's very important that we do that.
Well, I guess since you said so many of these crimes are unreported, there may be more male victims than
Correct.
You think.
Correct.
Yeah, I don't think it should be overlooked that it could be male or female. The gender isn't really a determinative issue as to whether or not you'll be exploited. It really is the amount of asset that the person has.
And sometimes asset doesn't even matter. I mean, I had a case where the gentleman was on a very limited income, and his son was taking almost every dime from him weekly. So it didn't matter about asset in that case. And I think, too, one other thing to remind people of is when we have budget cuts, Adult Protective Services is one of the agencies that just recently was literally on the chopping block. And I think it's unfortunate when it's an agency that's so necessary. And there's definitely a belief that family should take care of family. But when family's idea of taking care of family is literally like taking them under, then we as a community need to step in. And that's why awareness of the problem is so important, and being cognizant of the signs of abuse, neglect, or exploitation, so that if you do see something, and we all have that gut instinct, and most of us choose to ignore it. And I would encourage people to follow your gut, not only for the protection of the elders, but for you, because you too one day will be an elder. And we're all working very hard to protect that which we have, and to have someone take it out from underneath you is just, it's a crime.
We've only got a few seconds left, but Nan, can you just give us some bullets? How can seniors protect themselves? Are there ways other than calling you that they can do on their own to kind of limit the extent of abuse that could take place in the future?
I would encourage them to communicate if it's, you know, if they're being exploited, talk to their children about it. If they're, you know, I had a situation where a elderly person was asked to do a paint job, have their house painted. It's all brick, and the gentleman wanted to charge her over $3,000 to change, just paint the around the curb and or the gutter. We were able to communicate, and I was able to let her know there's resources that she should probably look into finding someone else to do it. And so communication is the big thing. Look at your banking accounts with someone. There's the third-party monitoring.
So having someone outside
a neutral person look at your assets, and they don't
like
have
what a CPA or something.
Someone within the banking institution, or someone that you feel trusted that is not tied into the family. Or in Jolene's book, The Legal Guide, 55 Legal Guide, is a great book to use for seniors to get information on how to protect assets and stuff.
Nan Mendenhall, she's director of the Division of Adult Protective Services for the state of Utah. Nan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Liz Salas is Public Information Officer for the Utah Department of Human Services. Liz, thanks to you.
Thank you.
And Greg Fairbrush, he is with the Utah Attorney General's Office. Greg, thanks for your time.
Thank you.
And up next, we have a conversation about going global with good works. But first, a break. This is City Views on KCPW, Salt Lake City. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Napier-Pierce, and this is City Views. The best-selling book, Three Cups of Tea, shows the difference one person can make in the developing world. It's a lesson one Utah woman takes to heart. Ray Farrelly discovered a need in remote Tanzania and has taken on the cause with gusto. Today on the program, she joins me to discuss how and why she decided to dip into the world of international humanitarian efforts. And Ray, good morning. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ray Farrelly is co-founder of Project Wayzatia. It's a nonprofit which is building a secondary school and funding a scholarship program in Tanzania. We'll give you more details on our website, kcpw.org. But if you'd like to join us, do you support an international cause or have you traveled to a developing nation to offer humanitarian service? What motivates you to give a helping hand in a distant land? You can give us a call. 801-355-TALK is our number, 801-355-8255, or send email to cityviews@kcpw.org. Ray, you have a small nonprofit working to build a school in Tanzania. How in the world did you get involved in this work?
So in 2008, well, first it started here in Salt Lake City, actually. I was an English language teacher for a newly arrived group of Burundi women, refugee populations, and I fell in love with them. I worked with them for a year, and they came in with no formal education background and no literacy skills, and I was a very experienced ESL teacher, and all of a sudden I didn't know how to work with this population who had no literacy background. So I became curious in East Africa and where the refugees were coming from, and then serendipitously, I was introduced to a man from Tanzania who was running a nonprofit in Western Tanzania, and he invited me over to establish an English language program and to train their English language teachers. So I went over, I prepaid, and I got there, and there was no school and no teachers. So I made the most of it, and then after 7 weeks kind of in the village and just learning Swahili and hanging out and, like I said, making the most of it, I just made a lot of friends. And then the next year I went back to visit some kids and visited a neighboring village. And the chief of that village made the big ask, similar to Greg Mortensen's experience in Pakistan, where the chief just asked if I would help them build a secondary school. And I had just read Three Cups of Tea on the flight over, and I was just so into his adventure. And I was like, oh, my God, that's amazing what he did. And then all of a sudden I have the opportunity.
This is still something of a hobby for you. Your day job is at the Center for Teaching and Learning Excellence at the University of Utah. So why? Why decide to dip overseas to do your good works? Why not target efforts closer to home? Or keep your efforts limited to working with the Burundi women? And
right. Yeah. No, it's a really good question. And I think it was just a matter of timing and not being able to say no. Loving this community, seeing that they weren't making the radar of the government in terms of getting a school built. So the kids, either when they finish primary, they don't get to continue to school, or they walk about 2 hours to another secondary school. So there's just no sense of opportunity or future for a lot of them. You know, it just ends after P7, which is, you know, they're about 12 or 13 when they finish that. And locally, you know, I continue to do work. I still work with refugee populations. I foster dogs, and I volunteer for all kinds of causes. So I kind of over good deed a little bit. But I also love world travel. I've been traveling since I was 18, and I always thought I'd end up in Latin America because I speak Spanish. So this just happened. And now I'm in Tanzania every year. This will be the fifth year back this summer.
There are quite a few Utah-based nonprofits that are involved in the international development sector. Globus Relief, Choice Humanitarian, Healing Hands for Haiti, Walesa Bugu Alliance. I mean, the list is quite lengthy. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to create your own foundation instead of approaching one of these more established foundations and say, hey, can you help me out here?
Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic because I always wanted to volunteer internationally. And until, I mean, I've been a graduate student for a long time. I got my master's, then my PhD. I never had the money to pay an organization to be a volunteer. And so many of them need, you know, a $2,000 to $5,000 contribution just to be a volunteer. So ironically, now I've started my own organization, and I pay my own way, and I pay my fees whenever I'm in country. So I guess I'm kind of paying to be a volunteer, but I feel like I'm having a much bigger impact than if I just went on, you know, a humanitarian expedition for 2 weeks with an organization.
Speaking with Dr. Ray Farrelly, she's co-founder of Project Wayzatia, a nonprofit which is building a secondary school in Tanzania. I think I said that wrong the first time.
They say Tanzania also. It's fine.
801-355-TALK is our number. We're talking about international development, helping people across the globe from a home base here in Utah. 801-355-TALK is our number. Ray, what's the hardest part of long-distance project building? I mean, you're overseeing a project that's thousands and thousands of miles away. How do you jump through the local regulations, the hoops that
maybe their cultural barriers, language mm-hmm. barriers. How do you do that from such a distance?
Well, I can say that it would not happen if I didn't have an amazing organizational partner in country, Lucas Lamek. He's Tanzanian. He was actually working for that organization that I went to work with the first year, and then he lost his job with them. And he's one of the only people I met that spoke English, so I asked him if he wanted to join forces with me and see if we could do this school building project, and he was really excited. So now he's salaried with Project Ways Asia. It's just he and I. I do all the fundraising, and he takes care of all the on-the-ground in-country efforts. And he is so trustworthy, and that is really hard to come by in Tanzania and many other developing countries. There's a lot of corruption, and if there isn't corruption, there's fear of corruption, so people are very cynical, and they're not very trusting of efforts. So Lucas paves the way, and I defer to him on all decisions, and then we go in together to meetings with the village leaders, and I let them, you know, make the decisions as they feel is appropriate for their culture and their village. Mm.
There have been some recent reports of safety concerns. College students who have gone on these humanitarian, you know, summer trips or whatever, and been threatened or been harassed or even injured. When you're traveling to these far-flung places yourself, have you ever felt like you're in danger?
You know, I've never felt in danger in Tanzania, although right outside the hotel I stayed at in the capital city, a girl's bag was ripped off her shoulder and we could hear her scream and stuff. But that could happen in New York City or Boston or Salt Lake City, you know.
Sure.
But no, I don't ever feel unsafe. In fact, I had my first intern go over this summer. She's there now. She contacted me from Colby College, and I wouldn't have let her go over if I thought that it was an unsafe place. Tanzania is very stable compared to a lot of other countries in Africa.
Mm-hmm. But is safety a concern? I mean, an ongoing concern? Maybe not in Tanzania, but in
I think so.
For other people who are looking to reach out in a very direct way in some unstable environments.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to keep in mind. And I think investigating the politics of the area, how heated it is, are there any tribal wars going on, religious wars. Tanzania's got a lot of different tribes and religions, and it's a very harmonious country, so we're lucky. But working in Ethiopia or Sudan or Somalia or other Pakistan, Afghanistan would be a whole nother story.
You founded Project Ways Asia in 2009. Mm-hmm. I understand you're preparing for another trip to the country in July. How do you measure success? I mean, it's 3 years into the project. Mm-hmm. Are bricks and mortar coming soon?
Yeah, they're going up right now. So it's going to be a 16-classroom school, and we finished 4 classrooms and 2 offices, all the bricks and the roofs, last summer, and now the next round of classrooms is coming. To this point, it's been sort of a nickel and dime affair. It's been me on Facebook asking friends and family and getting 25 here, 50 there, the occasional 500. But recently, because I've kept up with promotions and marketing, people have been finding me online. So I've had a couple of big things come my way. Recently, a first-year medical school class at UT Austin raised $15,000. And then
that's
another.
Gotta help.
Oh, it helps so much. I mean, that builds right there 3 or 4 classrooms. So our goal now with this new surge of funds that we've got is to finish and cut the ribbon on the school summer 2013. So I'm really hoping that's what's going to happen.
If someone wants to dive into this kind of humanitarian work, how do they do it? I mean, what advice, given your experience, what advice would you give somebody who's interested in starting a project or, you know, just someone just getting started in this?
I think let it happen organically. If there's a region in the world you want to be involved in, travel there first and just feel it out. Make connections and let them ask you for what they need. I never came in and said, hey, you guys need a secondary school or you need a scholarship program. I let them come to me and ask that question. So I think, you know, pick where you want to be invested and then see what comes your way. And it may not come, and then you can partner with other organizations, but let it be organic.
What is success going to mean for you?
Success will be finishing this school. It'll be turned over to the government, and the Ministry of Education will run it. So finishing it, getting the teachers and the students in, seeing the classrooms filled. And then we're going to try and keep an ongoing relationship and do some teacher development to support them, because building the school isn't where it ends. I don't want to throw up some bricks and walk away, because I know that it could result in teachers that don't show up, overcrowded classrooms, the students come to class, but they don't necessarily learn. So I just want to see it become a thriving learning community in this little village.
Tell us just briefly about the village. And what is Ways Asia?
Ways Asia means empower in Kiswahili.
Okay.
And Lucas and I came up with that name. We were trying to think what would be a good name. And so empowerment is at the heart of what we're doing. The village is, it's tucked in this, it's really remote. You take some public transportation to one village and then you walk about an hour through a forest of mostly mango trees and palm trees, which aren't native, but they're all over the place. And then you get to the village and it's just over the hill from Gombe National Forest, where Jane Goodall started all her chimpanzee research. So it's a beautiful area. It's pretty well forested and the villagers are connected to the environment and they want to keep the trees, unlike some of the other neighboring villages. So it's a really delightful village to work with.
Speaking with Dr. Ray Farrelly, she is the co-founder of Project Wayzesha, a nonprofit which is building a secondary school and funding a scholarship program in Tanzania. And Ray, thanks so much for your time. We'll have
links
on our website, kcpw.org. City Views is a production of KCPW News in Salt Lake City. Our technical director is Jesse Ellis. Tomorrow, a new guide for Mormon parents of gay children. Join me for that tomorrow. For City Views, I'm Jennifer.